If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. From the 15th century, the independent city-states that now make up much of Italy were taken over by a series of powerful families, whose wars and dynastic alliances marked the period as one of volatile politics and brutal power shifts. In her new book, Princes of the Renaissance, historian Mary Hollingsworth explores this web of alliances, looking not just at its political impact on the region, but also how the family's nurturing of artists and writers led to some of the most famous art and architecture of the Italian Renaissance. Putting the questions to Mary was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Today we're talking to Mary Hollingsworth about her new book, Princes of the Renaissance. And Mary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for asking me.
And I wondered, to start with, can you just introduce us or the listeners to the period that your book covers and very broadly what regions of Italy looked like during this period?
Yes, it's the book covers quite a large period of Italian history, so basically sort of 1400 to 1600. And during this time, the politics of the peninsula changed quite dramatically. And in a way, that's the subject of the book, is watching the way in which the politics changes. But it is the important thing to remember is that Italy isn't a unit. It's a collection of princely states, two republics and a lot of princely states. And some of them it's slightly more complicated because some of them are papal fiefs and some of them are imperial fiefs. So, you know, there's different sort of allegiances in that sense. And a lot of them change hands over the years that the book covers. And but basically the important point is that they're all separate and quite distinct places. Each has their own, for example, they each have their own currency. They each have their own systems of weights and measures. I mean, it's incredibly complicated from that point of view. You know, they a yard of something that you buy in Florence is a different length to the same word used that you buy in Venice, for example.
That must make research certainly a challenge, and there's a huge amount of detail in the book. And I've got a copy of it here in front of me, and I hope you don't mind me saying there are so many names and so many figures, and I've got some of the wonderful, very helpful family trees in front of me to help me navigate this chat. And there are many names that might be familiar to listeners. There's family members of the Medici that pop up. How do you go about choosing the figures to feature that tell the story of this period?
The important point about that is that they are princes. So the Medici, who normally feature quite heavily in the 15th century histories of Italy, are not princes at that stage. And so they don't feature at all until well into the 16th century. And so I've been quite specific about princes, and I haven't included popes either. So I've just included people who were, I suppose it's rather a snobbish way of putting it, were aristocrats, ruling, basically rulers, and not always rulers. Sometimes there's brothers and sisters, sometimes they're wives, but connected directly to. So the chapters all deal with more than one person, and the different sorts of relationships reflect the complexity. They were all related to each other in quite complicated ways, but it was a way of establishing allegiances. So, you know, if you wanted to be in an alliance with one particular person or one side of an argument, you know, you would form the alliance, and it wouldn't just be a formal treaty that you signed, but you'd celebrate it with a marriage between the two sides, so that then the children, you know, you can see how it rapidly became incredibly complicated. And of course, illegitimate children worked in this system as well. So it was, you know, illegitimate daughters wouldn't have quite such grand wives as legitimate daughters, but they also provided the link.
Right. Yes, you're right. It's a very complex web of alliances. Exactly. But the transfer of power, as well as these alliances, in many instances, it seems to be quite brutal, quite bullying tactics employed by some of these princes. Can you give any examples of, you know, the siege tactics or the plundering that went on?
I think practically every state in the 15th century, apart from every princely state, was acquired by brutal tactics. Sometimes it was just one family was rioting, you know, civic riots getting the better of another family and establishing themselves at the top of pecking order in that particular time. But quite a lot of them were won by, you know, major battles. So the King of Aragon, as in Spain, part of Spain, the King of Aragon sailed across the Mediterranean and conquered the Kingdom of Naples, which is most of Italy south of Rome. I mean, that is an immense area of land. But he did that, you know, that took him took him a decade. And he did that sort of, by winning battles against, you know, against the opposition. But more brutal were people like the Sforzas coming to power in Milan. And they just, you know, when they just besieged the city and starved the predecessors out. I mean, it is a brutal world, the world of the Renaissance.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you don't include popes in this account for the reason you've mentioned that you focused on the princes of this period. But during this period, the papacy had just come back to Italy from Avignon at the start of the period you're writing about. And how does the activity of the popes and their courts affect the period? What sort of influence could be attained by positions in it? You see that their influence on lots of these families you're writing about.
Yeah, that is the critical point, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't include any popes specifically as patrons, and they appear as patrons, but it's because they play a key role in this whole political machination. Because if you had the Pope on your side, you could get away with much more than if you didn't, if you had the Pope against you. The Pope had secular authority. Obviously, he was, you know, the head of the church, Catholic Church, but also he had a secular authority, a secular role. And he could pull, you know, if you don't do what I tell you, you know, God will get cross kind of line, which isn't, you know, which your average tyrant couldn't do. So it's quite difficult to explain, but the popes play an absolutely critical role. And one of the reasons is because the papacy has come back to Italy from after several, almost a century absence, and it dominated for the rest of from the 15th century onwards. It is dominated by Italians. So there's a non-Italian pope at the beginning of the 16th century who is, who's 1521 to 23, and the next foreign pope is John Paul II. So, like, that is a very long gap. So you can see how and one of the ways that they ensured their control of the papacy was always to appoint Italian cardinals, and a lot of the cardinals they appointed were members of these princely families who then went on to either to become Pope or, if they weren't, then to make sure they were, they became princely families. So the first Pope to do this is probably Pius II, 1458-64. He establishes his, he goes into an alliance with Alfonso, the King of Aragon, who by this stage is King of Naples as well, and to make sure, to establish his nephews in the in positions, you know, of so become dukes and various of dukes of various places within the kingdom of Naples. So other families use a different, you know, use, I don't know, imperial connections to get their, you know, to get their titles. But it's absolutely critical, it, the way in which the aristocratization of the Italian upper class, non sort of middle of middle ranking non-nobles, but not, what I say, barons, I suppose you might call them. I'm trying to think of a good, they're definitely not Republicans, that's for certain.
Right. So a lot of these princes then, throughout your book, you document, you look at how they become patrons of this burgeoning Renaissance culture, this human Renaissance humanism. Can you define that term for us to start with, and perhaps we can talk then about how they went about supporting these?
It's incredibly complicated. It's difficult because of the word. It's in itself, it's not complicated, but it's difficult because of the word, because we humanists in 21st century are quite unlike humanists in 15th and 16th century. A humanist was somebody who studied and read and wrote the literature of cultural remains or the literary remains of classical antiquity, particularly ancient Rome. And maybe, you know, they at the beginning of the 15th century, they were looking, they would, collect... they would collect manuscripts. They would search monastic libraries to find the manuscripts of the ancient authors that had, you know, so-called been lost in the Dark Ages. And anyway, they would read, and they would read histories and read the letters of Cicero and all these things, and then, you know, write their own sort of imitation. So they were kind of cultured, educated, but educated in a specific way, and not necessarily, I mean, educated in the classics. Ancient Greece, ancient Rome first, and then ancient Greece. And the word humanist comes, as used then, comes from the slang, student slang. They studied something called humanitas, and that was translated, and a humanista was the nickname for the professor that taught them. You know, a generic, you know, my humanista, or like my tutor, you might say my tutor in sort of modern parlance. So that's all it means. And it, over the centuries, and particularly during the Enlightenment, it developed an entirely different, not entirely different, but a different sort of meaning. Mm-hmm. Is that a bit clearer?
Yes. I think so. I mean, perhaps we could maybe talk about some examples of the types of art and literature that these rulers were becoming enamoured with and sponsoring and raising up in their courts.
Well, in particular, I mean, the first thing that happens is the coins that the, you know, these people who are looking, hunting for manuscripts in monastic libraries, you know, all they have to do is talk to the local farmers in northern Italy who would just, you know, every year they would just, you know, they'd plough their fields and it would be filled, it'd be turning up classical coins. And so people collected these coins, and, you know, the standard coin like we have, you know, it was sort of, it had a portrait head on one side and an inscription of various sorts, or an emblem or something on the other, and they made their own in imitation of the classical counterparts, and that's all starts in Ferrara and Rimini, which are not well known centres of the Renaissance, but those by the princes, you know, the princes, these are both places where princes had a particular interest in classical literature. And one was very warlike and one was very passive, pacific. So it doesn't seem to... of course, the great thing about the classical tradition is that it provides models for every sort of ruler. You know, you could have the serious-minded, cultural... You know, you could have somebody with a real taste flair for the culture of ancient Rome, or you couldn't, you know, tyrants, democrats, the lot. I mean, you know, democrat and republicans, sort of, these are all, you know, terms that derive ultimately from the ancient world.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
It suddenly, you know, it becomes real rather than talking about exalted things like Doric columns and, you know, drapery studies, but actually it's really just about dogs.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
So this harking back to classical antiquity, it also played out in some architecture that was being created renovated during this period? I'm not quite sure.
Well, the classical monuments were being built. But they were, I mean, the really interesting thing is, it's the idea is the revival of the classical orders of architecture. So the columns that you see on a building, in a modern build, even a sort of, you know, 19th century building, the top of the column has a kind of, is decorated in a particular way. And the classical theory was that the ancient Rome is that there were five different types of columns, and they each had a different, you know, Doric, Ionic, Corinthian composite. They each had their own particular decoration at the top. But then there's all sorts of interesting modern examples where people have been much more inventive, and, you know, so more inventive, more more specific to the period. You know, they'll put, I don't know, corn cobs or something. There's examples of that. But the point is that it's the revival of this particular type of column, and in particular its columns, according to the classical, should be carried on flat, so round columns on a flat architrave, whereas arches should be carried on piers, which are square in plan. If you think of the Colosseum, it's got both. So it has the piers at the back and the columns on the front. But it's the revival of those things that takes place at the beginning, around 1450 onwards, in northern Italy, at the courts at Rimini and Ferrara. Thanks very, in large part, to one of the most famous Renaissance architects, who's called Leon Battista Alberti, who actually isn't what we call, he isn't a trained architect. He's a trained, he's totally fascinated with ancient Roman culture. And he earns his money at the papal court as an abbreviator, which is a letter writer, I think you call it, sort of a clerk, really, at the papal court. And but he spent in his spare time, he digs up, you know, ancient Roman ships. And anyway, he's a kind of polymath, but he's a very interesting person. But he wrote treatises on all sorts of weird things, but very much in the same, in imitation of classical, the classical habit of writing treatises. So treatise on horse, for example, as all series of things.
I think something that's really interesting is how all of these elements were so crucial in many of these courts in projecting that sense of opulence, of power, of authority. And how, apart from the coins that you've already talked about, you know, how was it also used for kind of those propaganda purposes?
Well, I think I think very definitely it's the idea of being heir to the imperial tradition, ancient Roman imperial tradition, is quite important in Italy, because after all, Italy was the Roman Empire, you know, was the basis of the Roman Empire. And there was an awful lot of ancient Roman stuff still, you know. I mean, obviously there's a lot in there's a lot in Rome, but outside Rome, there are sort of, you know, there are arches, and I don't know anyone who's been to Verona, there's an amphitheatre in the centre of Verona. There are arches, in triumphal arches in Padua, Ancona, you know, there's sort of various places, an awful lot of stuff in and around Naples, which these people could very definitely call on and to use to show, you know, that they were part of the old ruling tradition. That was very much what they wanted. Competitively with each other, but not trying to revive the concept of the Roman Empire per se, but each of them as the individual, as it were, competitively, I'm the heir. No, I'm the heir.
Got you. That kind of power struggle coming into play again.
Yeah, exactly. There's an awful lot of power and a lot of rivalry, and, you know, I'm better than you, kind of, and I'm bigger than you. And also, the other thing is, I mean, it's just, nothing's really different. I mean, if you go to a city and it's filthy and, you know, the drains smell, you don't go, oh, this is a really grand place. Whereas if you, you know, you go somewhere and the buildings are huge and the streets are all paved and there isn't a drain smell, you get the impression that you're in the presence of somebody powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah.
I wanted to pick up on this idea of rivalries, because the way your book is structured, I don't want to say pit against one another, that's not what you're doing, but you look at various figures, often in relief to one another in the chapters. Can you talk a bit more about that approach and how you looked at the figures side by side, a few examples?
Okay, so in fact, oddly, it was slightly, this also was inspired by an ancient, you know, ancient Roman tradition of compare and contrast. I mean, we've all had compare and contrast essays to write over the, you know, it's a kind of, but it's one of the ways of getting, I just feel that it's an incredibly complicated period, and it's one of the ways of getting across the fact that there isn't a single way of looking at things. There's all sorts of, you know, different people with different views and different approaches to exactly the same problem. And I also wanted to get across the complexities of the relationships between people. So some of the people are rivals, and some of them are related, but not particularly, like the rulers of Ferrara and Rimini that I was talking about earlier. They're related, but they're not rivals in any remote sense. Whereas the King of Aragon and his counterpart becomes the Duke of Milan are complete rivals and come from totally different backgrounds. So they're not remote. They're not related. One is a son of a relatively ignorant mercenary soldier, and one, you know, can trace his family line back to sort of, you know, 800 AD across the Mediterranean. So there's a very sort of different. And then there's one chapter, for example, in which I concentrate on the husband and his wife. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fortunate. I mean, I can do in this particular instance, because actually a lot of their letters to each other have survived. And so you do get a sense of the human relationship between two people. This particular, the Mantua archives is filled with letters. And I mean, they, you know, so that's one of the reasons why it's possible to, to examine them in that way. Whereas you can't really, there's no sort of, there's much less domestic detail, for example, for the King of Aragon, mm-hmm. King of Naples. So it just depends a little bit on what's there. And then there's another, one of the chapters deals with a dynasty, how you establish and found a dynasty, much helped by a pope. That's just brothers and sisters and grandfathers kind of thing. So there's a big variation. And then there are chapters of rivals. Very distinctly, the Medici and the Este family have a major rivalry in the 16th century, which results in one of them going under, or nearly going under. And anyway, so that's sort of... I tried to not have too many identical sorts of, you know, I tried to have to pick as many sort of variations as I could.
Absolutely. Fascinating stuff. You mentioned the letters. Barbara is the one who had 14 children.
Yes. She's an amazing, she turns up as a young, you know, little girl from, she's German. She speaks, you know, she turns up as sort of 10-year-old and she speaks no Italian at all. She's not allowed to keep her, German, sort of household, because it's important that she forgets her German connections, as they say. And so she's just thrown in at the deep end at far too young to have any, but you know, I suppose, I mean, she's the niece of the emperor. And so she was brought up, this was going to happen to her, but maybe she didn't expect to move to Mantua. But she's very gamely, you know, carried on. And she obviously has a very, very close relationship with her husband, Ludovico. And the letters that survive are just absolutely charming. And they're details like there's on the front cover, there's a picture of Ludovico and Barbara. And that's their court. And if you look underneath at the bottom of the picture of Ludovico, there's a dog under his chair.
Yeah.
Okay. And the dog is called Rubino, and it's the old hunting dog, and he won't talk. You know, he's old and sort of he's grizzled, and anyway, the Marquis goes away off on business, and Barbara writes him a letter saying, you know, Ludovico, you didn't say goodbye to Rubino, and he's been pacing around the palace all afternoon looking for you. And you suddenly have this incredible sort of sense of real, just ordinary people with ordinary, you know, poor old dog.
Yeah, fantastic sense of domestic life.
Yeah, no, and it just makes life, it makes it so easy. It suddenly, you know, it becomes real rather than talking about exalted things like Doric columns and, you know, drapery studies. But actually, it's really just about dogs.
are there any other moments that you could share that kind of really brought this history to life in a new way that you found while writing this?
Well, it wasn't really about while I was writing it, because I trained as an architectural historian, and I then started about 20 years ago, I started looking at the papers of Cardinal Ippolito d'Este, who is one of the characters in the book. And it was just the sort of joy of just he left behind 2,000 plus letters, which are more about politics and lost dogs, let's face it. But he also left behind 200 account books. And so, I mean, literally everything that he spent and his household spent on every food, candles, horses, jewellery, material, food, more food. And there are lists of every week's, the week's shopping in at the palace in Rome, and how much they bought of everything and the prices of everything. And you get you suddenly realise, you know, everything is just, it's real life, and it's just ordinary life, and nothing, there's nothing fancy about it. Whereas this is, you know, this is the builder of the man who built the unbelievably stunning Villa d'Este at Tivoli, which is, you know, it's just cascading fountains. It has a water organ in it. you know, which is operated through with water. It's very quite clever. But he learned that he bought willow. He distilled willow, which is, I suppose, like salicyclic acid, to try and help his, he had gout. And this was what, you know, you could talk to doctors about, you could talk to practically anybody about this book. I've even managed to have a chat with a bloodstock agent, which is quite an achievement. Find something in common between an art historian and a bloodstock agent, I thought was quite an achievement. Anyway, but just, I mean, I didn't know anything about horses, and, you know, I do know a bit more now. So there is, you know, the real world is lurking out there, particularly in the documents, in the letters, and in the account books. And it's just that, you know, not that many people sit down and read it.
Mm-hmm. So as well as the various sources you've already talked about, I imagine there's a fair amount of travel that goes into this kind of research. Like you say, you've been doing it for years and years. And obviously it's a fairly difficult and challenging time to travel. What can you tell our listeners about the experience of going to the places that allow you to find out more about Renaissance Italy?
You can't do it at the moment. I think that's one of the things. I don't know whether the archives are open, but the Italians do have an amazing, they do have an amazing set of archives. And because, as I said at the beginning, these all were separate states. You know, there's an archive, there isn't just one, like we have the National Archives in Kew. You know, here there's a separate, there's an archive in, that's called Archivio di Stato, State Archives in Florence, and one in amazing building in Venice filled with all their documents. There's another, the one in Rome has, the one in the Vatican was substantially destroyed in the early 16th century, and the one in Naples was destroyed in the Second World War. So, or largely destroyed, but there's still all the Este archives are in Modena, all the Gonzaga archives are in Mantua, and all the Sforza archives are still in Milan. So there is a lot of material about, but it's just a question of patience. And one of the things that people always say to me, but how can you read it? And of course, it's incredibly simple, because they developed, another thing that the humanists did is they developed the italic script, which we all had to learn at, I mean, I don't know, you're not, I'm sure, I mean, if you're my age, you had to learn Italic handwriting at some stage. But it's, you know, the point is it's incredibly easy to read. And there are beautiful letters, you know, which are like sort of things that, you know, like letter, like writing cards, we would, you know, to copy. And also the other thing about reading accounts is it's very simple. It's like, you know, 5 pounds of butter at 2 pence a pound. You know, that doesn't really require an enormous amount of Italian to grasp what's going on. And also the other thing is that the vocabulary, Italian vocabulary, is much, much smaller in the 15th and 16th centuries than it is now. And a lot of it was in code. The letters were in code. So decoding a letter is quite, you know, is, you know, that's also perfectly possible. But it's they're just conveying factual information usually, and usually of a scandalous variety or something that they didn't want anyone else to know. So it was, you know, once the archives are open, it's very easy to, I suppose if you like this kind of thing, very enjoyable. Settling down to a day's work, there's always gold. It's lovely.
Yeah, no, it does sound fascinating hunting through for these gems, and hopefully when the world opens up a bit more, then people will be back to it soon.
I think so. Yes, hopefully. Exactly.
So just to perhaps wrap things up then, for anyone coming to Princes of the Renaissance, a bit cold, a bit kind of, you know, new to this kind of world of battling princes in Renaissance Italy, what would you like them to know about this account?
I'd like them to be interested in people, I think, and how different people react, and how history is about people, not necessarily the very grand people, but quite ordinary people as well. And also they did create some staggeringly beautiful things in 15th and 16th centuries. I mean, there's some very beautiful pictures, illustrations in the book. Yes, I would like them. They've got to be interested. I mean, otherwise, but people are interested in history. And I think what they don't like is, I mean, they're slightly put off by, you know, sort of political history exclusively can be quite off-putting for, you know, for somebody who doesn't know. You need to be able to try and bring it to life.
That was Mary Hollingsworth. Princes of the Renaissance is published by Head of Zeus and is out now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Ewart and Jack Bateman. Join us tomorrow for a conversation on medieval treachery.